Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that the current divisions between the Sanders and Clinton campaigns will continue and could become more strained as the primary process heads towards its likely conclusion in California on June 7th. Matt Lindstrom, a professor of political science at St. John's University, where he's also director of the Eugene J. McCarthy Center for Public Policy and Civic Engagement, joins us. We will discuss similarities shaping up between the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago and this year's Democratic Convention in terms of how the young flocked to Eugene McCarthy's 1968 campaign in huge numbers that resulted in a rift between the insurgent McCarthy and the establishment candidate Vice President Humphrey, who was narrowly beaten by Nixon, leaving a bitter residue in the Democratic Party, which effectively lost the executive branch for decades after. Then we are joined in the studio by award-winning investigative reporter, political columnist, and foreign correspondent Andrew Gumbel, whose latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. On the eve of tonight's primary election results in five states, we'll examine the truth in Donald Trump's charges that the system is rigged and look into why it is that the United States is alone among advanced democracies in having a deliberately complicated and easily gamed election system whose manifest flaws were exposed in Florida in 2000, but essentially remain as broken as ever today. A condition which appears to be the way the two major parties, the Democrats and especially the Republicans, want it. And joining us now is Matt Lindstrom, who's a professor of political science at St. John's University, where he's the director of the Eugene J. McCarthy Center for Public Policy and Civic Engagement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Lindstrom.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be here.
And as we approach the five state elections tonight, the results will be coming in a little over an hour or two, perhaps. There's more and more sort of focus in terms of the Bernie Sanders campaign in terms of suggesting analogies between the Bernie Sanders campaign as it is now and the campaign of Eugene McCarthy back in 1968, who was a Democratic insurgent at the time, getting enormous support running against an establishment figure in the form of Vice President Hubert Humphrey. And the analogies there are fairly obvious. But there are other ones as well, particularly in terms of how Eugene McCarthy was gaining huge crowds across the country, mostly young people. Now, they were certainly protesting the Vietnam War. But there are many, many analogies. In the last week, the Princeton historian Julian Zelizer wrote an article, What Bernie Sanders Should Learn from Eugene McCarthy. So it seems to be out there in the zeitgeist. As an expert on Eugene McCarthy, how does it strike you?
Yeah, you know, there have been a number of articles and a lot of commentary over the last 6-8 months on the similarities between Bernie Sanders and Eugene McCarthy, and really, no doubt there are. There are several similar attributes. The time is different in terms of the context and the culture and some of the global issues, but there's enough overlap that it does make sense to compare the two. I think that, as I mentioned, there's some similarities, but there's some important differences as well.
Well, let's start with the similarities. And obviously, the focus is that whether it's history or revisionist history, the idea being that McCarthy was a spoiler and Bernie Sanders could be a spoiler in terms of Hillary's chances later on. So let's deal with that first.
Yeah. I mean, no doubt. They're both McCarthy and Sanders took on a powerful kind of incumbent type figure. I mean, of course, McCarthy started off by challenging Lyndon Johnson in New Hampshire. Senator or Secretary Clinton is not a sitting incumbent per se, but effectively is. So that's the dramatic similarity. But of course, the difference is that Humphrey never actually. His name, you know, wasn't in the primaries. He didn't win primary elections like Sanders is doing over and over again. And so it was a deal done at the convention in 68, whereas today it's much more transparent and I think, frankly, more democratic with the caucus and primary system.
Well, of course, the comparisons are being made to the 68 convention in Chicago and the upcoming Republican convention in Cleveland in terms of possible anarchy and chaos. And I must say that so many of the people I've talked to who were at the convention in 1968, and most of them were supporters of either Bobby Kennedy or Eugene McCarthy, everybody I've talked to was severely beaten by the Chicago police. So I could well imagine you wanted to stick by your guy after that kind of treatment.
Absolutely. I mean, no doubt Richard Daley, Mayor Daley, was part of the kind of inner cabal of the Democratic Party. And the last thing they wanted was to have a so-called peacenik or anti-war person, Eugene McCarthy, kind of be the mantle of what they thought is their party. So, yeah, it was absolutely. In fact, at St. John's University here in Minnesota, where McCarthy graduated undergrad, we just celebrated his centennial year, and we had a number of people who were at the 68 convention. And in fact, you're right, did get beat. They were very, very upset. I don't see that happening in Philadelphia with the Democrats. Not sure what's going to happen in Cleveland, but I think the convention analogies or the convention similarities are perhaps closer to the Republicans this year versus the Democrats. I don't see a lot of similarities between 68 convention and the Democratic convention this year. But to a certain degree, it's a little bit more similar to the Republicans insofar as you'll have a candidate, Donald Trump, who will have the plurality of direct votes from the voters throughout the 50 states. But you know, again, if he doesn't get that 1237 majority, there will be a scenario where a big chunk of the convention and the broader Republican electorate will feel disenfranchised, will feel like, you know, the rug was pulled out underneath them and that type of thing. And that, I think that's what the McCarthy supporters were feeling in 68. He won these states. He had way, way, way more votes than anyone else. And again, like I mentioned, McCarthy didn't even win a primary. So they felt the rug was being pulled out and that their voice didn't matter and that the establishment was going to sort of do what they were going to do regardless of the democratic process that preceded the convention. So it's a lot. It's really quite fascinating. You know, Clinton definitely needs Sanders supporters. There's no doubt in the general election she's going to need the enthusiasm. She's going to need the money and really the kind of the day-to-day sort of work that takes place behind a successful campaign. Whether or not she gets that will depend on Bernie Sanders. And there again, we could talk about McCarthy and his lack of support for Humphrey and so forth. So.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Lindstrom, who's a professor of political science at St. John's University, where he's the director of the Eugene J. McCarthy Center for Public Policy and Civic Engagement. And, of course, one of the most extraordinary things that happened with this insurgent campaign of Eugene McCarthy in 1968 was, and of course, Lyndon Johnson, the president of the United States, was watching what was happening, and he just threw in the towel, didn't he?
Absolutely. Really quite historic. And people, my understanding is that folks didn't really see this coming as quickly as it did, particularly knowing the personality of Johnson and kind of the fierce tenacity to win and that type of thing, and at all costs almost. But yeah, it was a real shock. Definitely sent a signal to the country. Democratic Party at the time was unwilling to sort of take the risk with what was perceived as an insurgent or an outsider, non-mainstream, and that type of thing. So I think the culture, the political culture of the time is quite different today. I mean, 68, we had a draft, right? So way more people were impacted by war than they are today. We do have economic strife and stagnation and massive differences in wealth in the United States, and that's what, of course, people are fired up about with respect to the Sanders campaign. And I just don't, you know, going back to 68, I believe in. Of course, I can't speak for all the Humphrey supporters at the time, but I'm guessing that they didn't see much of a difference in terms of a Humphrey and Nixon both were perceived as pro-war and very, very mainstream, that type of thing. But I'm wondering if today, I'm thinking that many of the Sanders supporters will look at their alternatives, Clinton, let's say, versus a Trump or versus a Cruz. And I'm guessing they're going to see significant differences between a Clinton and a Trump, or a Clinton and a Cruz. Whether it's Clinton and Kasich, you know, that's another story. But so my point is that I see Sanders supporters pretty clearly and without much to do, going over and supporting Clinton. Certainly at the ballot box, the extent to which, you know, they donate and they door knock and that type of. That type of work, you know, remains to be seen. But, you know, it happened back in 08. Clinton supporters came over to Obama, and it was a fierce primary season, too, back in 08. So,
well, just to go through the timeline, though, just for our audience to do a little sort of rolling back the clock here in terms of history, since we're talking about historical analogies, possible ones between 1968 and 2016. Senator McCarthy, the insurgent anti-war campaigner who was drawing massive crowds of young people, just as Bernie Sanders is today, in the New Hampshire primary, he came in a strong second and shocked President Johnson, and that was on March the 16th. And certainly Senator Robert Kennedy noticed that, but he was sitting out the race because he thought that LBJ was unbeatable. But then only literally a couple of weeks later, on March the 31st, that's when Lyndon Johnson went on television and said he wasn't going to run again. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, brought Bobby Kennedy into the race. And then, of course, we all know that Bobby Kennedy was assassinated just after winning the California primary.
Yeah.
And we're sort of almost in the same timeline now. We've got the big five primaries coming up tonight, or the results of them, the voted on today, with Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware. I think I've forgotten one, but in any case, Rhode Island, right.
Yep.
Sorry. I don't discriminate against small states.
Right.
So one of the things that was extraordinary, though, about this situation in terms of analogies with today was that Eugene McCarthy, his anti-war message and his campaign, inspired a young junior from Wellesley College, Hillary Clinton, who had arrived at Wellesley as a Goldwater Republican, largely influenced by her father, who was a Republican, and then but quickly switched and became a supporter of McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
So irony of ironies, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It sure is. It sure is. And people evolve over time. And, I supporters of Secretary Clinton, I think, are correct in pushing back the critique that she's not authentic or she's not as liberal or progressive as they want her to be. I mean, she's different than Sanders, but I imagine, you know, you look at their voting record and it's quite similar over vast majority of the votes. Again, I don't see I don't see as much of a difference between a Sanders and a Clinton in terms of public policy. Yeah, their styles are different, the rhetoric and that type of thing. But in terms of actual public policy across the board, yeah, there's some differences, but across the board, I don't see as many differences on the key salient issues as there were between Humphrey and Eugene McCarthy. So, again, I think the Sanders people will indeed come on board with Secretary Clinton's campaign. I don't think that they will sort of follow the McCarthy lack of enthusiasm for supporting Humphrey in the general election back in 68, where he really, you know, just kind of didn't do as much as he could have, for sure, and his supporters kind of followed along, and we know what happened with the Democrats losing that, not only that in 62, but of course in 68 rather, but also in 72. So,
well, but the key thing was that the Democrats, and he was the incumbent vice president, Hubert Humphrey, and by all accounts, he was a fairly liberal guy.
Yeah.
And the person who beat him was Richard Nixon,
who
really established, in a way, a kind of Republican hold over the White House that was only ended by Bill Clinton. So, you know, the little lesson there, at least
yep.
the warning is there, right? That you
absolutely.
Know, if you, and Humphrey only lost by, what, about 100,000 votes. It was extremely
close. Yeah, it was very, very close.
Right. So that's the sort of warning that's out there, is it? That,
oh,
that if you don't support
real.
The...
No, no doubt about it. I mean, if one party or the other is fractured to the extent that they were in 68, you know, good luck winning in the general election. It's extremely difficult. And so, of course, you see that again. Yeah, you see it in the Democratic Party today. But I think the Sanders people will come on board quite quickly with the Clinton campaign, as will Senator Sanders. But on the GOP side, that's not going to happen. There's no unity candidate that's coming out of the GOP. I don't care whether it's Trump, Kasich, or some new name that they pull out, or certainly not Cruz. There's just absolutely no. I don't see any possibility for unity coming out of there. If Trump wins, it's certainly not going to happen. And if he doesn't win, it's certainly not going to happen. So,
no. In fact, in a way, as much as we're having a conversation about possible fratricide on the Democratic side compared to the Republicans this year, it's peace, love, and puka shells. I mean, it's
exactly.
crazy how I can't for the life of me see any kind of win scenario on the Republican side. No matter how you slice and dice it, it's not the outcomes aren't good. Whatever the combinations are, and even if you go through the so-called white knight scenario of
right.
having Paul Ryan ride in on a white horse, it still doesn't look good for them.
Not at all. No way. The Trump folks would reject that, thoroughly reject that, and fight against that scenario. And I think about the students I have here at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota, and we have sort of guessing here, maybe this year, maybe 60-40 Democrats to Republicans in terms of the results, but or the in the enthusiasm, that type of thing. But you know, the Republicans I speak with, I haven't met one student that supports Trump. These are the kids that are involved in the College Republicans and the more the activists and the rather than the kind of independent passé partisan, but. And so he faces a tremendous enthusiasm gap or lack of enthusiasm among very important constituencies, namely the most educated and involved people at all age brackets. So tremendous civil war on the Republican side.
So, but in terms of what might keep Bernie going, if indeed he doesn't do well tonight in the five states and... pollsters seem to indicate that Hillary's on a roll after that big win in New York. I am assuming that since he's raised so much money, his campaign people will want to keep going, won't they?
Yeah, you're right. I would assume that that's the case. I think he's would take this to California for sure. And right now, it looks like Clinton's in a pretty decent close, but... a slight lead in California. So, but the trend is, you know, New York was a real, real blow to Sanders' campaign. But look where he started, right? He started way, way, way low in the polls. So he's climbed up. He's continued to win a whole bunch of states. And yeah, he's got the money. And whether he has the math to get to the nomination, I don't think he does. But he certainly has the money and the motivation and, I don't see him dropping out anytime in the near future.
So in terms of the analogies between 68 and 2016 that are motivating young voters flocking to Bernie, obviously we don't have a war. We do, but I mean, they've been largely wound down. But of course, if Cruz or Trump got in, we would have a real war, or several of them. So there's a major difference there. But you could probably probably substitute the Vietnam War for Wall Street. In a way,
you can. I mean, I think that would be that's the direct connection. I just think it's not quite as strong. I mean, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement, and certainly everyone is impacted by the economy, no doubt. And we know that in the since the recovery of the Great Recession that the wealth has been highly concentrated in the very, very top percentages. But I just don't see, I don't see the kind of Wall Street and sort of Occupy Wall Street or the questions about wealth inequality and income inequality. I just don't see those as quite as powerful as a war where you have a draft and virtually everyone is, or every male, of course, is subjected to that for the most part, particularly the young people that we're talking about. I just don't see that. It's not quite as compelling or as doesn't quite create the same fire in your belly to get out there and campaign as a war where you have a draft. But nonetheless, Wall Street and income inequality, you know, is a huge issue.
Well, but wouldn't the draft, in terms of these historical analogies between 1968 and 2016, wouldn't the draft back then be the equivalent of student debt today?
I mean, I think there's a comparison. I just don't see as an equivalent in terms of the kind of an exact equivalent or the same level of power.
I'm sort of suggesting, but I'm suggesting skin in the game. In other words, you just made the point that back then you could get drafted and go off and die in some jungle in the middle of nowhere over a war that nobody quite understood what the hell it was about.
Sure.
So, yeah, the student debt is real. You got kids living at home, saddled for life.
Absolutely. Although I think it's very unevenly distributed, that the debt. I mean, to some extent, like the draft, we know that not everyone. We know that income and college attendance impacted your ability to be drafted, but so college debt is real. There's no doubt. I think it's far worse with the for-profit colleges, and Senator Sanders' proposal for kind of a continuation of the free community college, or instead of a K-12, it's more of a K-14 or K-16. That impacts people. He's talking about public universities, so which doesn't impact people at private colleges. But yeah, I think it's a similarity. People do have skin in the game, but I just think that I don't see the college debt as compelling of an issue as the war. I just don't. And frankly, if you have $30,000 worth of college debt, it's a big number. But you look at the alternatives of not going to college, and your lifetime income is far, far less. So all in all, even with the college debt, college is by and large a great return on your investment. Even with a $30,000 or $35,000, $40,000 debt.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Matt Lindstrom, let's turn to the aftermath, if you will. Obviously, McCarthy did impact and did contribute it to Hubert Humphrey's loss in 68 to Richard Nixon, who then, as we mentioned, created a fairly firm lock on the presidency for the Republicans going all the way through Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and only to be broken by Bill Clinton. And that's all pretty clear. And the follow-on in terms of if Bernie Sanders doesn't make it, what do you think is going to happen to all those students? Because as soon as Nixon ended the Vietnam War, the whole anti-war movement just sort of dissipated and didn't become a continuing political movement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are now questioning whether or not Bernie Sanders could continue this movement that he's created, because arguably the young people that he's brought into politics, they are the future of the Democratic Party. And if the Democratic Party is not stupid and brain dead, they ought to be able to find a way to work with these kids.
No, you're absolutely right. From a strategy point of view, it would be absolutely foolish to discount or write off, ignore, or somehow not include Senator Sanders, for sure, starting with the convention. I mean, he has to have a very, very prominent, back up a little bit, if I'm the strategist to try to wave my magic wand and what would be the perfect scenario for the Democrats this summer at the convention, you want, and then let's assume Secretary Clinton, takes the majority of delegates, you want Senator Sanders with a prime time spot at that convention, day one or day two, right off the bat, and to give a rousing endorsement of Clinton, and then Clinton, who, and we've seen this happen just particularly in the last month or so, she has to continue to incorporate the issues and a little bit more of the forceful rhetoric that Sanders has really injected into the campaign. And like I say, we've seen her do this with respect to the $15 an hour wage and student debt and some other things. And I see her doing that. She's obviously super smart, and she's got plenty of staff and so forth to tell her what to do and what their ideas are. So, but if they don't incorporate Sanders in a predominant way, and he's kind of shunned to the side or some early morning talk or something like that, I mean, it could spell big trouble. I don't see that happening, though.
Well, Matt Lindstrom, I thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a privilege. Thanks for the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Lindstrom, who's a professor of political science at St. John's University, where he is the director of the Eugene J. McCarthy Center for Public Policy and Civic Engagement. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined in the studio by award-winning investigative reporter, political columnist, and foreign correspondent Andrew Gumbel to talk about his latest book just out, Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America.
Don't need to change your future's odd. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your gold, give us your
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Nation, and The Atlantic. And he's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book, just out, is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And just last week, of course, in New York, the elections were beset. In Brooklyn, 125,000 people were purged from the rolls. And prior to that, of course, Trump's own children couldn't vote because they didn't register. And people think New York is a fairly liberal, progressive state, but it has one of the most repressive, reactionary, and user-unfriendly election systems of all the states. In many ways, it's even worse than Mississippi. So here we are in the midst of elections, and tomorrow you've got five states voting. And it's just extraordinary to think that with the case recently in Arizona, and now what happened in Brooklyn, the impression you get is that the people who control elections in here at both, you know, at the state and county level, their focus seems to be on purging people and making it difficult, not making it easy to vote. There's a culture of dysfunction and almost contempt for the voter. Am I exaggerating here?
Not by much. I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's important when we look at what happened in New York to separate out a couple of things. One is what happens in general elections, and then one is what happens in primaries. And they're related. They both have to do with what I would describe as the insidious influence of the two-party system. It's not about Democrats behaving better or worse than Republicans or vice versa. It's something that both parties have been at for a very long time. In the primaries, what you see in state after state is a desire by both parties in their different ways to maximize control over a process when they know they have to pay lip service to the popular will, but really what they want to do is nominate their own candidate. You see that over and over again. In New York, I think this is a relic of the history of New York, actually, when you've had a very long, contentious battle between the power centers in Albany and in New York City, where there's been a desire by one side or the other. It was about power centers rather than about parties to restrict the ability of the other side to maximize their advantage. So New York has a long history where the voting rules are pretty restrictive. There's no same-day registration. There's no early voting. There's no out-of-precinct voting. And as we saw in the primary, they had this wrinkle whereby if you were a new voter, you could declare your party affiliation at the time you registered, which was just a few weeks before the vote. However, if you were not a new voter and you were not registered to one party or the other and you wanted to participate in one primary or the other, you had to say so by the previous October. And this was something that was not even advertised. So the comparisons to the Deep South pertain in a rather sinister way. When North Carolina's monster law, as it's known, came up for judicial review, the defenders of the monster law, which cracked down on a lot of the progressive reforms that North Carolina had in place for 2008, cited New York as justification for saying, we can do this. And, you know, the broader cultural background is, you know, New York, it's Democrats for the most part in charge. In North Carolina these days, it's Republicans mostly in charge. So it's not about one party or the other. It's about the desire for control. And that desire for control has trumped adherence to what we think of as representative democracy, which is believing that the people should decide.
Well, not to belabor the pun, trumped, but Donald Trump, of course, of late has been calling out the Republican Party, calling out Reince Priebus, calling out the RNC, saying they're crooked, the whole system is rigged, etc. And of course, here's your subtitle of your book, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. It almost could be coming from Donald Trump's lips, right?
I think that's right. Well, certainly the primary process in both parties is rigged and deliberately so, because they want to have the best possible chance for the Republican establishment candidate to win. What's fascinating in the Republican race this year is, of course, all attempts in that direction have collapsed spectacularly, and Donald Trump has been the main beneficiary. What we're looking at now as we reach the end game is, you know, you have Ted Cruz, who is very good at playing the inside game. He's very organized, very disciplined, has a large staff to try and wrest every delegate opportunity he can away from Trump. And Trump, who is less well organized, not that focused, is crying foul. You know, I keep thinking of Boss Tweed back in the 1860s, who'd say, what are you going to do about it? You know, Trump, if he wants to win, needs to play the game. Now, you can say that the game needs to be fairer, and I would agree with that. But the fact is, the game is what it is. Trump knew what he was letting himself in for. And if he really wants to win this nomination, he's going to have to play the game. He's hired Paul Manafort, who has a history as, you know, a Nixon-era dirty trickster. He helped Gerald Ford to secure his nomination in 1976 when he was challenged by Ronald Reagan. So, you know, that's somebody who is a good person to have on your side. It remains to be seen whether Manafort and the rest of the team are getting along, whether they can get their ducks in a row, whether they can, you know, stem the bleeding that Ted Cruz has inflicted so far. As an outsider, it's a fascinating thing to watch. Is it democratic? Not especially.
Well, David Plouffe, who, was, of course, successfully ran Barack Obama's campaigns, he recently tweeted in relation to this Trump-Cruz battle over peeling off delegates that have already voted for Trump. He described the Trump election team as epic malpractice. But he wasn't criticizing the system. He was criticizing the fact that they weren't playing the game as well as Trump was playing. So the culture, again, you get back to the culture. The culture is such that you have a system that's so dysfunctional and so crooked that it's up for gaming, and that becomes the point, right? It's all about how you game the system, not how you reform it.
That's right, and it's worth pointing out as well that most of the gaming that goes on goes unnoticed, and the presidential race is very different in that respect because it has this glaring spotlight, so we see all the flaws. Whether you're looking at the money in politics, whether you're looking at the rules, whether you're looking at the dysfunctional state of a lot of county election offices which count the votes, most of this stuff goes unnoticed unless there's a contentious, very close election where it comes down to a few votes, or if there is some kind of successful advocacy effort or popular revolt against the overfunding of a side that clearly is against the public interest. For the most part, it goes unnoticed. The interesting thing about the presidential race, because it's so visible, is it teaches lessons to the American electorate about their own system. We saw that in 2000 when people were stunned by what went on in Florida. It had been going on for years, but it just hadn't mattered as much before. And we're seeing it now, you know, when we just think about the money piece. Let's talk about the money piece for a moment. You know, Citizens United, which inaugurated this new era of unlimited independent spending for campaigns, a very low degree of accountability of where the money was coming from, transparency and so on. The working assumption was that this would be enormously helpful to incumbents. It would help establishments. It would help the parties maintain their grip on the people that they had in office, the candidates that they would choose and promote, et cetera, et cetera. What we've seen, especially on the Republican side, is that we now have a situation where candidates can effectively be like artists in the Renaissance, where all they need is one patron. And they can keep their candidacy going for as long as it takes to try and drum up as many votes as they can. Ultimately, it's about the votes in the primaries and the caucuses. But at least starting out, you saw 17 or 18 candidates on the Republican side, a lot of whom would never have lasted 5 seconds before Citizens United. The establishment candidates ended up not being able to compete. The Scott Walkers, the Jeb Bushes, they all had to drop out because their money wasn't actually useful in the end. And, you know, for people like me who have deep misgivings about the way the system works, to see this, you know, the unintended consequences play out in this way is rather delicious. The question then is, will the system get reformed properly as a result of these dysfunctions? And the most likely answer to that question is the parties will make another attempt to change the rules to benefit them and maximize their control.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Nation, and The Atlantic. And he's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book just out is Down to the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And you mentioned 2000 as being a wake-up call where the American people suddenly realized that their election system was akin to a banana republic. And, of course, there were some reforms, but they've basically gone nowhere. The Federal Election Commission is completely paralyzed. And curiously enough, what happened in Florida in 2000 was almost a repeat of what happened in Florida in 1876 when Rutherford Hayes won the election that the other guy won. And, of course, he then earned the moniker Rutherfraud Hayes.
Right. Well, obviously, the historical circumstances were different. In 1876, it was the tail end of Reconstruction. The Republican Party was desperate to hold on to power at all costs because they were worried about the Union collapsing. And so they essentially stole the vote in three southern states, of which Florida was one, you're quite right. And then it actually lasted longer than Florida in 2000, if that's possible. It lasted into the new year and was decided not by the entire Supreme Court, but by one Supreme Court justice who was the swing vote on a special commission that was set up. He was a Republican. He ultimately sided with Hayes. The footnote, which I talk about in my book, which is rather fascinating, is that William Rehnquist, who was the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, in 2000, wrote a book a few years later, just before he died, in which he went back to 1876 and justified what Justice Bradley, the key justice in that case, had done as a way of justifying what he and the other justices did in 2000 when they suspended the vote and awarded the election to George W. Bush without finding out whether or not he'd actually earned it. So you see a continuity there of, you know, again, the establishment wanting to close down any unpleasantness rather than confront it and deal with it. And that's a very disturbing trend in American politics. What's happened since 2000, I think, is fascinating because I think it's worth emphasizing there's a tremendous desire by Americans and in office, out of office, rank and file voters to have a better system. And we saw this energy at work. A lot of new things came along after 2000 that are unimpeachably good things, like provisional voting rules being tightened up, like early voting being expanded massively, same-day registration becoming a possibility, so on and so forth. Why that hasn't stuck, what I argue in the book is it's happened. Two things have stood in the way. One is that the politics from the top down have got in the way, in the parties and party leaders don't want these, especially the Republicans are very afraid of improved voter access leading to more votes for Democrats. And that's why you've seen this epidemic of voter ID laws, why you've seen a lot of these progressive reforms being reversed in states where Republicans run the state legislature. And you also have a problem of politics from the bottom up, which is that for decades, you know, more than a century really, voting offices, elections offices around the country, not all of them, there's some that are run beautifully, have been left in a state of dishevelment, underpaid, underqualified people who are responsible for counting the votes. They end up getting cozy with vendors who have shoddy machines to sell. They then defend the machines when they're indefensible. The machines don't work very well. And what you then get is a situation when there's a close race, there is ample opportunity for either side to argue the case that they're the true winner, which then gives a lot of employment to election lawyers, a lot of time spent in courtrooms arguing the case. And parties like it, it seems, because they want the opportunity in the event of a close race to try and wrest victory out of the jaws of defeat. And we've seen that over and over since the 2000 election.
And of course, this engenders a kind of conspiracy feeling amongst a lot of voters, and a lot of reporters have made a kind of hobby out of slicing and dicing whether the machines paper ballots, whether the machines are crooked, whether somebody in a back room can hack a machine and basically with a stroke of an electronic key change the results. This has all come since Florida, and the net result of which is that it depresses the electorate, surely. If you think that your voting doesn't matter because the machines are rigged and the system is rigged, you know, exactly being encouraged to show up at the polls. So not only has Florida 2000 been a disaster and the some reforms that have followed have kind of petered out or lost steam, as you just told us, my sense is that it's also brought about this general sense in amongst the electorate, which we have the lowest turnouts of all the advanced democracies in the first place, is that it's created a kind of atmosphere that there's a conspiracy out there.
I think that's right. I wouldn't say that it's just depressed turnout. In some places, it's actually stimulated turnout. Let me explain what I mean by that. First of all, I think it's true the paranoia exists. It exists on both sides. And your listeners may be less aware that, you know, whenever Republicans lose elections, in many parts of the country, the knee-jerk response of Republican rank-and-file voters and the candidates themselves often is to say that the election must have been stolen. There must have been busloads of immigrants coming in and voting illegally. There must have been this. There must have been that. How that plays into the Republican base often is in primary elections, especially the kinds of Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, who are liable to believe that elections are being stolen by immigrants, by criminals, by whoever, will then come out and vote in large numbers for the Tea Party candidate in primary elections. And a large part of the reason why in states where they have voter ID laws or even votes where they propose voter ID laws in order to crack down on this supposed problem of fraud that doesn't actually exist, it's been very effective to kick moderates out of office and have Tea Party Republicans get into their place. It happened in Texas in the most dramatic fashion imaginable and in other places too. And on the Democratic side, yes, it can depress turnout, but it can also stimulate it. If you look at what's happened in North Carolina, the response to the monster law there, which cracked down a lot of the progressive reforms, was to prompt a huge African-American turnout in the 2014 midterms. Unfortunately, it was not quite enough from their point of view to push the Democratic candidate for Senate over the top. Kay Hagan, she lost to Tom Tillis in a squeaker. But you see different patterns in different places. I think the general sense that things do not work has a depressive effect. But when specific party groups feel that they can make a crucial difference by coming out and protesting, they do. And we've seen that in the last few years.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and continue the conversation with Andrew Gumbel. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Andrew Gumbelin, an award-winning investigative reporter and foreign correspondent whose latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. And it's interesting, though, that in the Florida recount, a couple of key players showed up. Ted Cruz, who's running for president, and John Roberts. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that... And then, of course, the John Roberts Court, in effect, rewarded the Republicans by getting rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which has had manifestly clear results, has it not? Within seconds, almost, of that ruling, Texas ruled to change its laws. And now in Texas, of course, it's easier to get registered with a firearms license than it is with a student ID card. So these are the results. There's no question in my mind that those things followed. So with the top court in the land ruling in Bush v. Gore against all of the logic of their positions on the conservative side of states' rights, etc., that was bad enough. But then Section 5, stripping Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act out, saying that basically, oh, the country's all healed and we're all, you know, peace, love and puka shells and we don't need it anymore, has clearly proven not to be the case. So is there a reason to be sort of cynical about our justices in the highest court in the land? Are they that partisan?
I think it's certainly true that the Supreme Court historically has been very bad on the issue of voting rights. Going all the way back to Dred Scott in the 19th century, there was one terrible ruling after another. Where we are now is a very interesting pass because John Roberts, who you mentioned as being somebody with a long-standing interest in overturning the Voting Rights Act, when he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, actually managed to gut one section of it and get rid of the preclearance provision, which means that the Justice Department no longer has the power to approve or disapprove new voting laws in areas under its protection, which are mostly in the South, but not just. What's very interesting is the way he justified his ruling was by saying, talking about present conditions. Since Shelby versus Holder in 2013, which was the key ruling in the case, we've seen present conditions deteriorate dramatically in a way that even conservatives in certain cases have acknowledged has been bewildering and clearly counter to the interests of minority voting rights. The case will, or the issue will come back to the Supreme Court at some point because of the cases that have been brought in Texas and North Carolina in particular, where the lower court in Texas was particularly outspoken, saying that the voter ID law in Texas was a violation of the Constitution and a violation of minority rights in particular. It'll be interesting to see what happens because, of course, when the case comes back, we will have a different Supreme Court. You'll have John Roberts who will have to defend his standard of present conditions. And you may well, depending whether the court is an 4-4 court, excuse me, or whether we have a ninth justice and it's a more liberal justice, and we can't predict where Merrick Garland, if he ends up on the court, will rule. But it'll certainly be a different complexion to the court that may very well rule differently. Shelby versus Holder was a 5-4 ruling. It could go the other way this time. Going the other way, it must be emphasized, does not reinstate the Voting Rights Act as it was. Only Congress can do that. And the current Congress, dominated by Tea Party Republicans, is unlikely to do so, even though the Republicans in 2006 overwhelmingly renewed the Voting Rights Act. So we're at a perilous moment where we may find that the courts tacitly acknowledge that their previous ruling was wrong. We may have a situation where there is a clamor in the states where the injustices has been done to reverse things, but it could take years for Congress to actually act in the right direction. So it's a depressing state of affairs.
And of course, we saw what happened in Wisconsin, where Governor Walker did change the laws in ways that are similar to Texas. And I think what you were saying earlier, Andrew Gumbel, that sometimes it backfires, and rather than depress the vote, it activates people to insist on voting, and the long student lines, etc. My daughter was voting there, and all kinds of ID had to be shown. It was, you know, really cumbersome and unnecessarily so, and deliberately so. And that's the part of it that I find extraordinary, is that as a culture and as a democracy, why do we accept the idea that it's okay to try and stop the other side from voting when, you know, it's a kind of denial of everything that a democracy stands for? You know, you're supposed to have a better argument, not be able to cheat and lie and steal. I mean, that is not the way the game should be played. And how can you look yourself in the mirror?
Well, a couple of things. One is culturally, I think what happens is that parties and individual voters tend to look at the system like team sports. It's the Yankees versus the Red Sox. You know, if you want to press for a rule change, you're only going to press for a rule change that benefits your team. There's no sense in the culture in which we exist that there should be a level playing field where everybody plays by the same rules. I find this whenever I write anything on this subject. You read the comments section, it's always Republicans bashing Democrats and Democrats bashing Republicans. That's all you ever hear. And, you know, the very unpopular thing I tell audiences when I speak on this subject is rank and file voters of both parties need to get together, talk to each other, and make common cause to demand a better system. And people look at me like I'm insane for suggesting such a thing. You know, what the United States uniquely does not have, and every other advanced democracy does have, is an institution that is nonpartisan, that sets rules and standards that everybody has to abide by. The idea that every county, every state can set its own rules, set its own standards to a large degree, with minimal federal oversight, with rather toothless oversight bodies. You mentioned the Federal Electoral Commission. There's also the Election Assistance Commission that was set up in the wake of the Help America Vote Act in 2002. Similarly toothless. In fact, Congress has proposed many times to abolish it altogether. It's an untenable situation. It would be relatively easy to fix. My suggestion—
By the way, Andrew, everything we've talked about in this interview so far is easy to fix. Other countries do it.
I mean, right
next door in Mexico, where the PRI used to steal votes routinely, they now have a national ID card. People are registered when they're 18 automatically, and the elections are clean. It's not rocket science to run clean elections. Almost all the other democracies do it. So, you know, that's the part that I don't understand, is that the fixes are so easy, but there's clearly a deliberate and systematic effort not to fix things, in fact, to make them more complicated.
Right. And I think, you know, you can look at a number, you know, the two parties have grown up with this culture is reason number one. Number two is the extraordinary influence of money in politics, which is not unique to the United States, but it's far worse here than anywhere else. And now we have a situation where, and also the tradition of politicians in Washington being very suspicious of anything that smacks of too much government, which is a very American conversation as well. The idea that you would have an electoral commission that would oversee things would be immediately dismissed as, you know, big brother government or...
But you were just saying a minute ago that the reason it doesn't get fixed is because of the two-party system, the Tweedledum, Tweedledee party system we have between Republicans and Democrats. But the statistics don't bear that out, because by far the biggest block of voters in this country are independents. And that number is growing all the time. So there's a dissatisfaction with the two-party system, clearly, because people are registering more and more as independents. And that is also worth noting, that two of the leading candidates in this current race have been socialists on the Democratic side, the longest-serving independent in American history, Bernie Sanders. And on the Republican side, it's pretty hard to conclude that Donald Trump is a lifelong Republican and his own party are trying to stop him at every turn. So, you know, there's a change underway. So do you think the independents can clean it up? I mean, but they're amorphous, aren't they? They're not organized.
I think you're absolutely right that there's a political energy in the country that wants change, but there's no mechanism there to provide it. There's no mechanism really for independents to run for office as independents, which is why Bernie Sanders ran as a Democrat, why Donald Trump ran as a Republican. You also have a problem with the way that members of Congress get elected, and also state legislators, that you have the district-based system where you have two problems there. One is the way populations are distributed, which means that people tend to clump together in groups that naturally create majorities for one party or the other. You obviously have the compounding factor of gerrymandering on top of that, that can insulate parties from competitive races and or overturn majorities just by sheer virtue of mathematical sleight of hand. Ideally you would have an electoral landscape where third-party candidates were able to participate in debates, were able to raise money, were able to compete in a meaningful way. Ideally, you would have experimentation with things like single-rank voting, which would diminish the the rigidity of the district-based system and make it more possible for more voices to be heard. But these are conversations that don't happen. There's a very short attention span in this country. You know, we've talked a lot about voting rules and access to the ballot and so on and so forth. It's a problem in every election in many jurisdictions, but it only gets talked about when there's a close election, when there's a contest, when things get nasty. And then as soon as that contest gets resolved, people tend to move on. The media tends to move on. There's no attention focused on saying, okay, that happened. Now let's make sure it doesn't happen again. After Florida, there was a commission set up by Jeb Bush, who was then governor. It actually came up with some surprisingly intelligent suggestions. Were any of them followed? Almost none of them were.
Well, just now in the last couple of minutes, Andrew Gumbel, since we're an hour or so before we'll start hearing results from the five big primaries today in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Maryland, et cetera, and clearly, this is moving Donald Trump closer to the 1237 delegate number, and it's probably likely to propel Hillary Clinton further towards the nomination. But that doesn't mean there's not going to be a train wreck in Cleveland, from what we understand. And will that have an effect, again, of a cleansing effect? It'll be such a mess. And, you know, you've got, it's an open carry state, so if they screw with Donald Trump, all of his supporters outside the venue in Cleveland are perfectly free to carry AK-47s and AR-15 assault rifles.
Right. Well, I'm not a number cruncher, but the number crunchers say that Donald Trump is going to have a very hard time reaching the number of delegates he needs to clinch the nomination before the convention. So that then gives the Republican Party a very difficult choice to make. They've made it very clear they would love to stop him if they can. And the slogan that I've heard Republicans use is lose with Cruz, on the basis that he may do less damage in terms of Senate races, in terms of House races, and so on and so forth, and also damage the brand of the Republican Party less. However, you know, it remains to be seen whether they have the nerve to do that. One interesting historical parallel, again, from 1876, the Republican Party then, this was in the days before, you know, primaries and caucuses where people voted, but the front runner for the Republican nomination, James G. Blaine from Maine, was stopped because the party decided he couldn't be the candidate and they would do anything to stop him. And, you know, the moral of the story is they managed to do it, but it caused tremendous damage. And it meant that Rutherford B. Hayes almost lost the election. In fact, he did lose the election, but he was awarded it anyway. And that taint of improper practice hung over the Republican Party really for a very long time. And it wasn't until about 1896 when they really reasserted their control. So for 20 years, they were set back by this ugly intra-party coup that they staged. And the Republican Party is going to have to think about that very hard as they go into Cleveland.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today in the studio, Andrew Gumbel.
It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who's worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, in The Independent, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.